Well, hello, men. Welcome to the Man in the Pew podcast, brought to you by maninthepew.com. I'm your host, Phil Mershon, and this is the show for everyday men who want to follow Jesus every day, at work, at home, at church, and at play. I'm so excited for today's podcast episode with Dan Miller. Dan and I are going to discuss if it's okay to love the work that you do. We'll discuss so much more, including building your own personal sanctuary. Look forward to sharing with you this episode. Welcome to the Man in the Pew podcast. I'm Phil Mershon. I'm your host. This is the podcast for men who want to figure out how to live the daily walk of faith all week long. I'm here today with our special guest, Dan Miller. Dan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Phil. I'm honored to be one of your first guests.
So if you don't know Dan, Dan is the author of 48 Days to a Life You'll Love. And we're going to talk today about some of the concepts in that book. But before we get there, Dan, I would love for you to share with the men listening today, when did you first come to faith? And give us a couple of highlights of your work journey to date. I know you've been in the workplace for a long time, that you didn't start as a book author. So tell us about your faith and a bit of your work journey.
Wow. Okay. That covers a lot of territory. I'll be brief. Well, my dad was a pastor, so I never knew anything but getting up on Sunday morning, going to church Sunday night, Wednesday night. We were farmers. That meant that we had to cram that in around that, but we never missed Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and then special meetings during the week. So I grew up with a strong foundation of faith, but as you know, that doesn't necessarily transition to a life of faith just because you have the habits that look like that. But I really have had a strong spiritual faith since the day I can remember. You know, always recognizing, especially being out on the farm, I think it enhanced that, recognizing that there was something bigger than us. You know, when we would wait on rain and then see it come and things would grow, just watching the process of nature really gave me a strong faith from as early as I can remember. So it's been an ongoing journey and really not wavering a whole lot, even as I grew up. But work-wise, I did grow up in a farm, but I really had a curiosity that there must be other things to do other than getting up at 5:30 in the morning, milking cows, you know, and throwing hay bales in the heat of the summer. And so I saw books as my escape route to considering other options. We were very conservative, very legalistic. My dad was a Mennonite pastor, so we didn't have TV or radio. But books were my friends. Books are what opened the door to those experiences that we could be more, see more, do more, go more, have more. And I just really believed that. Somewhere in that process, when I was about 13, got a hold of the little audio recording, The Strangest Secret by Earl Nightingale. And he says, you know, biblical principle, we become what we think about. And I was very, very strict about what I allowed into my mind. And that's continued to be a foundational principle for me today. But I went off to college to give myself more options, got degrees in clinical psychology, but it was more a personal process of discovery than it was to define a career path. I'm an entrepreneur from the top of my head to the tip of my toes. I've never had a real job, so I never looked for a real job as a counselor or therapist. But again, that was part of my own personal growth process. But then about when I was about 45 years old, there was a convergence of things. I'd come through a real business disaster based on some poor decisions I made. And in recovering from that, I started teaching a Sunday school class, and we called it Career Life Transitions, and found that it was just like a vacuum in the community. We started having people come from other churches and other states. So we moved it to a Monday night where we would have two uninterrupted hours, did that for 8 years. And that really formed the foundation for everything that I do today. Out of that came the principles of 48 Days to the Work You Love, and out of that came the seminars and personal coaching that I do today. So now I am a coach, author, speaker, love the things that I get to do every day. And it's in helping people really define, how has God gifted you, and how can we translate that then into meaningful work on Monday morning? So it's not just getting a paycheck, but it's work that is meaningful, purposeful, and profitable. So it's been a delightful journey, and I feel very privileged to have just kind of kept my eyes and ears open to God's leading through all those years.
Thank you for sharing that story. And I would encourage the men to go and listen to Dan talk more about his story. I know you went through a bankruptcy and it was an intense time for you. And so I think it's very helpful to hear that journey. But today I want to focus on something I know a lot of men struggle with and Christians in general. And that is this question of, can I really enjoy my work? Should I really enjoy my work? And to give it a little bit of context, we know back in the Garden of Eden that God planted Adam and Eve there. He gave them work to do. And then the curse came along after they sinned in Genesis chapter 3. So Eve ate of the fruit. We may think of it as an apple. Adam quickly followed her into sin, and in fact, sinned by not even saying anything when she wanted to eat of it. And one of the curses was that work is now going to be hard. So yes, work is hard, but there wasn't that curse on it prior to the sin. I would just love for you to think about theologically for men, but also practically, should we enjoy work? What does that mean to you?
Well, it's a great setup for that. And we often hear about how work is a curse. And so we just assume that it is still today. But, you know, if we read a little farther in Genesis, we only have to read three more chapters to get to the part right after the flood where God says, never again will work be like that. That was not an eternal curse. It was just a reminder that, yeah, you have to use your hands and your mind and your back, perhaps, but it certainly is not intended to be a curse. And we find scripture again and again and again that we ought to enjoy our work. You know, Solomon, even in his darkest moments, said, you know, that a man should enjoy his work. It's a gift from God, and we expect that. And we ought to do work as unto the Lord. But to think that we are required to spend the major part of our time doing something that we would really not enjoy, I mean, I can't understand a God who would work like that. I mean, take the example of being a daddy. Would you want your child, just to teach them good things, to be miserable the majority of their lifetime? Well, certainly not. You know, and again and again, we're reminded that work should bring us joy. It should be our greatest opportunity to be salt and light. And if we're not doing something that we thoroughly enjoy, it's impossible to be doing it in a way that's attractive to other people, that's salt and light. Work is our best opportunity to fulfill our mission and our calling.
So it seems like there's a couple aspects of that. One is, how do we find enjoyment in the work that we have, no matter what it is that we're given? You know, we know Brother Lawrence found a way to enjoy being a dishwasher, and he's known for his prayers. And I think you talked about in your podcast that I'll reference, Martin Luther talking about be the best street sweeper that you can be. So there's an enjoyment in the work that we're given, but then there's also a pursuit of work that we can find true joy and satisfaction in. Maybe there's some other ways to divide it, but could you talk about at least those two different aspects of finding enjoyment in work?
Well, I think there are times when we go through seasons, and certainly we can learn from those. But if somebody's been in a position where they really find their work distasteful, where it's not a good application of their best God-given talents, and they've been there for 20 years, I think that's a personal failure. I don't think that's God keeping them there. I think that's a personal failure to take action because, you know, how else can God get our attention but by helping us understand that this isn't a good fit? You know, this is frustrating. This leaves me exhausted, emotionally drained. I mean, you know, physical symptoms. I mean, when I hear people walking around and they have, you know, headaches and migraines and backache and all kinds of things, boy, I mean, I think it's God trying to get our attention, saying something's out of line here. This isn't right. So I find it hard to ever justify a case where somebody is doing work that's really distasteful to them personally and saying, no, this is just your, you know, cross to bear or whatever. You got to just do this. No, I think that's a prompt to find something that's a better fit. Now, what happens, and I love, the old Martin Luther quotation to, if you're a street sweeper, do it so the angels sing. I mean, certainly that's true. And there are people who are street sweepers who love what they're doing. Sometimes I'm challenged on this, Phil, in saying, well, if everybody did what they love to do, you know, then we wouldn't have garbage collectors and ditch diggers and plumbers and electricians. Well, sure we could. And I was on a radio interview not too long ago, and there was a guy who called in. It was on Moody Radio out of Chicago, and a guy who called in, and he is a plumber who fixes people's broken water pipes. That's primarily what he does. So he's always the hero. Now, to me, crawling around under a house, especially in the dead of winter in Chicago, to me would sound horrible. He absolutely loves what he gets to do because he's always the hero. People call it the problem. He's able to fix it. They're appreciative of what he does. He thinks it's awesome. So in as much as there may be a position that I don't find appealing, somebody else will. So this goal, this kind of elusive goal of having work that we really love, can everybody do that? I believe every single person can and should move in the direction of having work that they absolutely love.
So it would sound like, and I know there's going to be guys here who are in the military, who work in corporate America, who work for, you know, in places that I might find hard to work in, but they might say, should I leave this? Should I just go out on my own? You're an entrepreneur, and it sounds like a very entrepreneurial thing to say that to find work you love requires that you go off on your own and do something. Is that what you're saying?
No, not at all. Well, that's a great question. Thank you for clarifying that. There is never a time when I'm telling people that ultimately you ought to be an entrepreneur to really do work that you love. No, we have wonderful, wonderful work model options today. We have traditional employees who show up at 8 and leave at 5. We have people who are consultants, people who are freelancers, independent contractors, have franchises. You know, there's a whole lot of different models. The challenge is to understand that we have those broad array of models and then choose where you fit best. And if that's as an employee, then hold your head high and do it with excellence. There's no shame in that at all. And there's plenty of opportunities within that traditional model to find something that really is a great fit. I had a gentleman recently who came through our coaching mastery program. And in that, we train coaches to really build a successful coaching business. Well, he had left a corporate position, was in our program for an entire year, and he did okay. But it was never really an out-of-the-park success. And I met with him for lunch. I said, you know, just kind of share with me what's going on. He said, I miss being part of a team. I miss the camaraderie that I had going to the office every day. I said, man, you need to get a job. You need to get a job right now. Don't ignore that unrest that you have. You did a valiant attempt at making this work. It was something new. It was kind of the grass is always greener, you know, scratching that itch. But you've now recognized there are reasons for you having done so well previously. You need to go to get a job. Well, he did. It was this tremendous relief to know that it was okay to do that. Got a job, $140,000. His wife is thrilled. He comes home at 5 o'clock, leaves work there, not doing work on evenings and weekends like he was trying to do before. I mean, what a beautiful, beautiful story ending to have him go get a job, be part of a team, and know that that's the best place for him. That's my goal, is to help people understand what is the best place for you. But I don't think you have to compromise in terms of thinking, well, if you aren't your own boss, you can't be doing work you love. Well, sure you can. There are a lot of people who are great members of teams and should remain so.
That's a great point. You know, one of the things that I hear said a lot about millennials is that they have a sense of entitlement. And this philosophy that you are talking about, that we should pursue work that we love, there's a way at which any of us who take that attitude could go about work and say, well, if I don't love it, I'm not going to do it. And that could leave a lot of things undone in the business and people saying, well, that's not my thing. I'm not going to do it. And all of a sudden, there are the people who are going to be left picking up the scraps, doing the work that nobody else will do because they just don't like it. So what do you say to that kind of adverse effect of this philosophy?
Well, in my own business, I mean, as a good example of that, you know, I have a small business as an author, speaker, coach, and there are probably 20, 25 things that need to be done. I probably do 2 or 3 of those pretty well. That's where I spend 97% of my time. But you know what? I have a bookkeeper. Now, I hate financial details. I hate looking at P&Ls and spreadsheets. To me, it's just a necessary evil. You know, I glance at them and then just go on with doing the things that I love, and that's, you know, serving people well and making money. But I have a bookkeeper who absolutely loves what she does. She comes in, she knows the back end of my business better than I do. She goes through my records, she makes everything whistle and sing, makes it all come together in a beautiful, beautiful way. She does that. I have people who do web design. People ask me, well, what are you using on your website to do this? I laugh, I have no idea. I have no more idea how to build a website than I would how to build a rocket ship. But I have people who do, who excel at that. That's their sweet spot. So my challenge is to find people whose skills complement my own. I don't have to do anything, but that's true in any business. There are going to be things that a particular person is not good at, and any good business will allow that person to spend the majority of their time doing what they do best. That doesn't mean things are going to not get done. That means you find a person to do those other things whose sweet spot that is. And I don't think there's anything. I mean, I don't care if it's cleaning the, you know, washing the floor or the windows or cleaning out the trash cans. There are people who do an excellent job of doing that and take a lot of pride in doing that. So we can find people for which it's a good fit. That's the challenge. Whether you're working for yourself or working as part of a team, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And if you find yourself repeatedly doing something that you don't enjoy, then you need to come up with a strategy for either how to get it off your plate on someone who does enjoy it, or finding someone to hire that can do that. It may require having frank conversations with those around you. But I think there may be another way to look at this, and I want to get your take on this. Because I remember Bill Hendricks wrote a book, You Can't Be Anything You Want to Be, or something like that. I forget the name of it. His dad was Howard Hendricks, and I plan to have him on the show here in a few weeks. He said some of the way that we need to think about our work is not just what we're doing, but the way in which we do our work. So God has wired us, every one of us, uniquely. And if you give the same job to five different people, they're probably going to do that job in five different ways if you leave them to their own designs. And so I think some of that is a really good thing, that I'm going to go about doing a job in the way that suits my interests and my passions and my designs, assuming I'm doing a good job and I'm not being wasteful. I'm going to find more delight in doing that job in the way that fits me. You know, I'm a creative person, so I come at things in a creative way that's different from an engineer, but we might be able to get similar results if I'm left to be able to do it in my own way. Does that make sense, what I'm describing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good thing. Yeah, that we have enough variety to choose methods for getting the end result that's required. You know, where people resist is when they're told exactly how to do things. I mean, in as much as we had a lot of people who seemingly survived doing industrial work, working on assembly lines, that doesn't fit a whole lot of people real well to just show up and do repetitive tasks over and over and over again in the same way. That's not a model that really tends to bring out the best in people. And of course, we've seen that kind of go away in our current workplace, where we are going back more to using people's innovative and creative skills and giving them opportunity to find solutions in their own ways. You know, when you interview today and you interview with companies like Microsoft or Google, you know, they aren't saying, what is 2 + 2? They're saying, you know, why are manhole covers round? Or let's say you woke up this morning and it's totally dark in your house and you know you have 14 blue socks and 14 black socks in a drawer. How many do you have to draw out to be absolutely sure that you've got a match? I mean, they're asking questions that make you think. They want people to think. They don't want just robots. We can get robots to do robotic work, but people who have value in today's marketplace understand their unique approaches and their unique value.
I agree with that completely. So a corollary to finding work that you love is to advance. So let's say you work for a company or you have a business that's got to remain competitive and become a leader in the marketplace. You've got to work hard. You've got to be productive. You've got to produce more than your competitor, whether that's a colleague at work or that's another business. And many of us feel like that means I've got to work longer to work harder. What's your answer to that? So, you know, because we're all men, we have many things we're balancing in our lives. We have families, we have children. We want to be active in our church and in our community. We want to be successful in our work. What are some things that you've found over time that have left you in a place that you can give your best in this work that you enjoy and still have energy left for these other things that you also want to be committed to?
Yeah, great question. I love going there. There's a couple things. One is understand the idea of what I do best. So I don't spend a lot of time doing things that I just kind of blunder through. So I want to know, what is that deep work? Work that only I can do and where it really taps into the very best that God has given to me. I want to make sure I spend time there. So I'm going to be very, very careful about committing time to things that are just time fillers. I have in my week, I finish all my availability and contact to the outside world at noon on Wednesday. From then on, I'm off the radar because I'm working on projects that I consider to be my most important work. So that doesn't involve email, Facebook, and those kind of things. I'm doing deep work. Now, the other thing is, you know, in terms of making my time very, very strategic in how I use it, that doesn't mean that I ignore, you know, things that are important. Now, when I say that I'm off the radar, I mean, believe me, if one of my grandkids walks into my office on Thursday morning, I don't say, ooh, I can see you on Tuesday at 10 o'clock. I mean, I'm flexible in doing that, but I want to be very, very careful about how I use my time wisely. The other thing, Phil, that's a major, major principle for me is getting away from this idea that more hours equates to more work or more dollars. That's a very antiquated model in today's environment, to think that if I'm, you know, working 40 hours a week and I want to double my income, I've got to work 80 hours a week. No, that, I don't recommend that for anything. If you're working 50 or 60 hours a week, you're already borrowing from success in other areas of your life that are putting you on a dangerous path. I know you're going to be borrowing from health, spiritual vitality, family, personal relationships, community involvement. You're going to be borrowing from some of those other areas when you go over that magic 40 hours a week anyway. So I look for things that move me from linear income to residual income. Now, this may not be an easy step for everybody, but I think it's pretty available to most people. And I've helped a lot of physicians, attorneys, dentists, pastors, people like that move into this who think they are locked into a linear model. Linear simply means you do something once and get paid once. And most attorneys are using the same income model as the kid at McDonald's who asks you if you want fries with that. They do something once and get paid once. What I do is look for, what can I do once and get paid 1,000 times? Those are the things that give me tremendous freedom so that I'm not locked into, wow, if I'm not sitting in my office doing some kind of work, I'm not making money. No, Joanna and I spent a month in England this summer. Didn't have any impact on my income at all, because I have systems and things in place that continue to generate income, even if I'm not there personally. Now, again, I've taken kind of a leap with that, but that's available to a lot of people where it's right under their nose and they don't realize it, and they just think that the only way to make more money is to put in more time, and thus, if they put in more time with the family, they're sacrificing income, and vice versa. That's not true.
Your statement that if you're working 50 or 60 hours a week, you're borrowing from someplace else is actually startling, because I think most of us think 50 or 60 is the norm, that we should be working 50 or 60 hours a week. And I know Ford is the one who figured out that 40 hours is actually where he get the maximum output from people at the factory. So I've seen the data on that, and he did way better than his competitors who worked people 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. So what is that, 72-hour work week? So that's radical, but it's startling to hear you say that we should be waking up to say that if you're working more than 40 hours a week, you're borrowing from some other part of your life. what are some things that you've done to help people that you coach step away from the frenzied work pace that we feel caught into?
One of the things I look at are their physical habits right out of the gate. There are a lot of people who are working on 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night, thinking that they're being more productive. I totally disagree. I am totally 100% convinced they're compromising their productivity by sleeping that few hours. I think most people are going to require 7 to 8. I personally require at least that, if not more, and typically take a nap in the afternoon. When my body is tired, I rest. I don't just push through, and taking a nap after lunch or early afternoon makes me more alert at 4 o'clock than what most people are, where they're just dragging because, you know, they ate a heavy lunch and now they're just pushing through until that magic 5 o'clock hour. I pay attention to my body, you know, whatever it's telling me. You know, if I'm hungry, I eat a snack. If I'm thirsty, I take a drink. But if I'm tired, I sleep. And that's one of the first things that I look at with people. What are you doing physically? And a lot of people are running on fumes, trying to be more productive, and all they're doing is mediocre work and everything that they do. So, you know, let's pay attention to that. You know, let's get serious about it. Sometimes when I work with an executive, somebody who's doing really, really well, I'll have them for 2 weeks track their work day in 15-minute increments. And then we look at it. What are you really spending time doing? One of the things that's so common today is that we're distracted. We're so attuned to social media. So Facebook thing pops up, or email, or Instagram, you know, or the phone rings, you get a text. I mean, all those things are instantly available. That's not how you get work done. I mean, we know that it takes 18 minutes approximately to get back to the level of deep work after you've had an interruption. And you know the funny thing, Phil? Most people don't go through their day without having any 18-minute stretch of not being interrupted. They never go even that long without being interrupted. So their work is very superficial. They don't tap into really what it is they can do best. One of the things that has contributed to my productivity most is working in focused, uninterrupted blocks of time. When I'm writing, I don't grab 10 minutes here or there. I work for 3 or 4 hours straight because it allows me to really follow train of thought, to research, to pull things together, to walk around in my office and pull books off a shelf that I read 3 years ago because I know right where there's a passage that I want to reference in what I'm writing. So I have very long periods of uninterrupted work, and most people today never experience that at all. And I think it keeps them from being their very best.
I completely agree that when I am successful in eliminating those distractions and can create longer periods of time, I get way better work done. I'm much more satisfied at the end of the day. And I've been finding recently that taking a short nap, 20 minutes, actually does make a huge difference at the end of the day.
Yes. So. Absolutely. Now, Phil, it's funny talking to you because I know you're a big wake at social media marketing world where you teach everybody all the benefits of all those things that I mentioned and kind of put in a category. Those things are wonderful tools. They're wonderful tools. Now, the other thing is a lot of people confuse themselves thinking that when they're involved in those things, they're actually involved in business. And a lot of times they're not. Those things are tools, but they aren't really the essence of a business. I had one of our coaches recently. I was working with her. She came out of a corporate position, a very competent lady, and she has spent 6 months working on her website, on Facebook posts, on getting her email set up and having an Instagram presence and all of that. And I said, Joanne, I want you to, and she's never had a paying client. That's my point. She has never generated a penny in her new business. I said, I want you to close your computer. I want you to go down to the local coffee house and spend the whole afternoon there. Talk to people. Talk to people about what they're doing, where they want to go, where they see themselves 3 years from now. You're going to get coaching clients by real interactions. Don't confuse yourself or deceive yourself by stepping out of what really makes a business work by using just these tools to confuse yourself and procrastinate.
Yeah, I find that you know, I have a real legitimate reason for being on social media because my job's related to it. But I find it can be a major distraction if I check it too many times during the day. And I've seen the statistics of how many times the average person is checking Facebook and checking their email and phone, and it can be a major drain. I'm impressed that you can spend 2.5 days a week doing deep work, but I wonder what you say to the guys listening who they're not their own boss, so someone else is responsible for, you know, their time and is watching over them, and they've got to report in where they spent their time during the day. How do they allow themselves to get into that place of doing the deeper work that's going to be more satisfying?
Well, I want to be careful in how I frame this, but we all make choices. If that's the best choice for them, then do that and be happy you have that opportunity. But if you see it as not the best choice, then create a plan to transition to something better. I mean, what I have now didn't happen overnight, but I was very, very clear on what the ideal would be. My commute in the morning is to walk out the front door of my house, and I walk 300 yards across a nature trail through the woods to this converted barn on our property where I have my office. Now, we have an event center here, so we have our Coaching with Excellence, and the events that we do are here. We have guest quarters here. But 95% of the time, I'm the only person in this building. That's very strategic. I know how I'm wired, how I work best, and how I'm most productive. So I created the work that fits me. That's not going, if somebody's real social and outgoing, a backslapper, cheerleader, the way I work would drive them crazy. They'd be bored out of their mind. So it's not for everybody, but I know myself that well. I mean, that's really, in 48 Days to the Work You Love, I talk about the fact that 85% of the process of having a confidence of proper direction in our career comes from looking inward first. We're too quick to say, well, here's a new opportunity, or here's a business opportunity, you know, or here's somebody that's hiring, and so we go in that direction. Now, 85% is looking inward. How has God uniquely gifted you in terms of skills and abilities, personality tendencies, values, dreams, and passions? From those, you ought to be able to get a real clear focus about what work would embrace those things you know about yourself. Then 15%. Is the application process. 15% is finding an organization where that would be embraced, or starting something on your own where you would be able to do that. I mean, that's really the easy part, but most people never draw that line in the sand and take the time to really look at themselves. Thus, they get pushed along, you know, like on the railroad of life with a locomotive right behind them, and all of a sudden, 20 years have gone by. And I worked with a gentleman recently, Phil, who took a job. He described to me, you know, he's in between opportunities. He took a job at a local bank. They offered him a temp position there, you know, and he thought, well, that's cool. He knows the people there. That's fine. He can do that for 2 or 3 months while he really figures out what he wants to do. That was 14 years ago. He's still there. That's what happens. We get into that. Yeah, gee, we got a mortgage. We got student loans to repay, and now we got kids going to college in addition. You know, and so we just get trapped in doing the same thing. The status quo is really an appealing position. It takes a lot of initiative to say, this is not the best. This is not ideal for me. And when things are okay, I mean, we know the old adage, good is the enemy of the best. And that's really true for a lot of people who are in jobs. It's okay, but not great. That's why oftentimes it takes a train wreck. And in that case, you know, losing a job. Losing a job? Wow. I talked to a guy just this week who has a very prestigious position at a very prestigious university. He was out. They called, HR called a meeting. He was not even there. There were 50 people in the room. He's part of a group of 34, and they told the 34, clean out your desk and leave. We don't need you anymore. Instantly, at a university where you'd think there's some kind of security. You know, that happens, but we just have to recognize what is our greatest marketable skills so we can be able to make those adjustments and define clearly where there would be the next best opportunity.
So give me like the 90-second version of the book 48 days. What do you walk people through? I presume it's a 48-day process. I don't know that for certain, but just describe to the men listening what your book is about and what they would get out of that process of going through it.
Well, thanks. Yeah, that's been pretty much my core message for a long time. The material was developed in teaching a Sunday school class after coming through a real tough transition myself that you kind of alluded to in the introduction. And it was during that period of time I started teaching a class, and that's where I got this material, working with real-life individuals going through these relentless, inevitable transitions and seeing how they could come out the other side with victory and joy. So the book walks through, how do you define your skills and abilities? How do you understand your personality? How do you relate best to other people? What kind of environments are you most comfortable in? How do you manage, persuade, sell, those kind of things? And then what are your deepest values, dreams, and passions? What are those recurring themes that show up where you know, wow, when I was doing that, I was really in the zone. We talk about athletes being in the zone. So we help you identify those times. Understanding those things about yourself then allows you to create a clear focus. So it's then and only then that we start looking at resumes, a job search, negotiating salary. And that's really most of the mechanics of the book deal with that. The last third of the book deals with that, with those traditional kind of things. How do you do a job search that gets you results that other people don't get? How do you find those opportunities that are in what we call a hidden job market? How can you negotiate to add another $20,000 after they've made you an offer? And very, very common to do that. So those are the things. And yes, it is a 48-day process. And the reason it's 48 days is because as a career coach years ago, I was frustrated by the fact that I would work with somebody who said, gee, my job is really sucking the life out of me. I don't want to do this anymore. We'd sit down, carefully map out a plan based on the things I just described. We'd map out a plan of transition. 2 years later, I'd run into them and they hadn't done anything. I'm like, what's up with that? How is that possible? Well, they're waiting until they get another degree, wait until the kids are out of high school, you know, wait until all the lights are green before they leave the house. And I thought, you know what? There's got to be a timeline connected with this. So it's not just when it suits. Let's make this a time-sensitive process. This was back when 48 Hours was becoming popular as a TV show. And being a branding marketing guy, I thought, I'll bet I could get some recognition of the 48 if I use that. It's an unusual number. It's not 30, 60, 90, or a year. And when I started making it 48 days to the work you love, it was like somebody threw gasoline on my business. And people were asking, you mean I really can change my life in 48 days? And my answer has always been, yes, you can, if you create a plan and act on it. Left to itself, nothing will change. But if you create a plan and act on it, you can make dramatic changes to get new results. And when I work with people personally, I'm really a stickler on that. I mean, if we work together and on day 49, you're continuing to do what you did on day one, I'll still love you and be your friend. But I'm moving on in terms of people that I spend time with. I work with people who are taking action to get the results they tell me they want.
Fantastic. I will include links to Dan's book and the other resources. I know you've got a community of people and you do coaching and other things along those lines. I want to finish with two last questions, Dan. One is, I asked you earlier before this interview, what's something that you do that, or a time in your life when you found that time stood still? And as we were reflecting on it prior to this conversation, you actually built a place that slows time down for you. And I wondered if you could just describe what you did and why that's so important to the way you live your life.
Sure. When I describe the fact that I work in a situation that I consider ideal, because I was very, very clear on what that would look like and then mapped it out and brought that into reality. Now, again, it took a period of time, but on our property, we have this barn. Now, it really is a barn. I'm an old farm kid, so I love barn structures. So it looks like a barn, but it's pretty classy inside in terms of being a creative, artistic kind of place. We have very comfortable guest rooms, two of them, and then my office. I worked with a couple designers and actually a feng shui specialist for my office to make sure that it was set up in an absolutely ideal way for me in terms of colors, position of my desk based on looking out the window. And when you look out the window, now we have on our property some eagles, some sculpted eagles. And I have outside my window in a very strategic position a bronze eagle with its wings totally spread out. Momentum is too far forward on the branch to stay there. It's totally committed to get in the game. That really is the essence of my business, and that's what I see right out my window every minute when I'm sitting here at my desk, is that eagle. Dream, plan, act. That really is the essence of my message. But it's in this place right here that I feel most creative, most inspired. It's a haven of peace, which is my wife's description. We call it the sanctuary. And those things allow me to do what I consider my most productive, most important work in life. I have visited other places. I've been to the Abbey of Gethsemane, the monastery where Thomas Merton spent his last years, looking for other ways to really get in touch spiritually and psychologically, to get in touch with really who I am and what might be there that I hadn't yet discovered. And really, there's no place on earth where I'd find that to be easier than right here in my own property in what we call the sanctuary.
Fantastic. I would love to visit there someday.
You need to. Yeah.
I will have to. I've got friends in Franklin and actually work for a ministry that's based in Franklin, so I have reason to come there.
Good.
Last question. What's a book you've read in the last year that's been transformational for you?
Essentialism by Greg McKeown. And you've heard me kind of touch on some things here, but it's deciding what is really important. What really is making a difference? How much of what we're doing now are just non-essential things that we could move to the side, delegate, or not do at all? But it was transformational. I've read it 3 times this year. Yep, Essentialism, Greg McKeown.
Fantastic. I actually just taught some of the key principles of essentialism to our staff yesterday. It's definitely on my top list of this year as well.
Good.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for being on the show. Ladies and gentlemen who are mostly listening here, make sure you check out Dan's work at 48days.com. And with that, Dan, we will end today's show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me as your guest, Bill.
Well, there you have it, men. Another episode of Man in the Pew with Dan Miller. I sure enjoyed that show, and I hope you did too. If you want to see the show notes, go to maninthepew.com/002, and you can find those as well as links to other episodes that we've had in the past. Really would appreciate your ratings and review on iTunes. That's going to help us be discovered by others who might be able to benefit from these shows and these interviews. Hopefully it's an encouragement to many. Go and change your world, and have a great day.